appearance of an extraordinary, wonderful book. My name is Rabbi J.J. Schachter. I had the privilege of working together with Rabbi Reuven Ziegler on this book for many years. And whenever a book appears about Rav Soloveitchik, it's a yontif, and it's a really a great occasion. Baruch Shechiyanu, v'kiyanu v'kiyanu l'zman hazeh. Rabbi Ziegler and I began a conversation, I think it was maybe 8 years ago or 9 years ago, about the publication of this book. And now, Baruch Hashem, we have a completed project. The book started when I was the dean of the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Institute of Boston, and we devoted a lot of energy to make possible the understanding of and the propagation of the Torah of the Rav. Rabbi Ziegler had a number of shiurim on the virtual Beis Medrash site of Gush on the Rav that he had been working on for a long time that I looked at and very much impressed me, and I thought this would be a wonderful shidduch if we could prevail upon him to put it together as a book, to be able to publish it, to even further spread the impact of what it was that he had to share. I had spoken to him when we first started about trying to do what is a formidable task, which he did with absolute brilliance, and that is to try to make the teachings of the Rav in all of its complexity accessible to, I framed it, a senior high school honors class or adults who are not so terribly sophisticated with a background in philosophy who would be very interested in learning about the Torah of the Rav. And Baruch Hashem, he was extraordinarily successful. Rabbi Ziegler lives in Alon Shvut. He's the director of research and archives of the Torah Sorah Foundation. He's the editor-in-chief of Yeshivat Haaretz Yon's virtual Beis Medrash, teaches for Atid in Israel, edited already a number of books on the teachings of the Rav, and now was able to write his own to explicate the Torah of the Rav and make it available to a broader audience. Hakaras HaTov first goes to the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Institute, the formerly existing, no longer existing, and particularly to the family of Abel Lovitz, who sponsored this volume in his memory. And I'd like to thank Dr. Tzachi Goldberg, who's here this afternoon, for writing the dedication to describe a little bit about who Abe was and bringing him alive. And there's certainly no greater way to perpetuate the memory of Abe than by linking him to the Torah of the Rav. He was so close to the Rav over all these years. I want to thank Urim Publications and Zvi Maurer for working with us so carefully and so diligently and so professionally to produce a wonderful volume. We have this afternoon the privilege of hearing from two extraordinary thinkers, academic and Rashi Yeshiva, who have expertise in the Torah of the Rav, Talmidim of the Rav themselves, each one for a number of years, steeped in the Torah of the Rav. Dr. David Schatz, an expert in philosophy in general and a particular expertise in the Rav, professor of philosophy at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, one of the most popular and influential Rosh Yeshiva in our Yeshiva, who's done a lot to perpetuate the Torah Sarav through his Talmidim and through his oral presentations, his Torah Shavar Sav and Torah Shavar Peh over the years. We also want to thank Sam Ulrich of the Sperm Sale for making this possible. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Schatz.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Schachter. I was just wondering whether it's a coincidence that the Super Bowl tonight is between New England and New York, the two places where the Rav lives. As far as I know, Berlin has never been to the Super Bowl. Academics have a very annoying habit, and that is that they quote themselves. I know some professors, when we ask them a question, they climb up on a ladder, pull down a book, and they say, let's see what I have to say about that. Well, let me tell you what I have to say on a blurb on the back of Rabbi Ziegler's book. This volume is an ideal entree into Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, but it is even more than this. The author, Rabbi Ziegler, presents fresh, penetrating perspectives and insights that will enlighten even seasoned readers. All who care about Jewish thought should read this outstanding work. And that's just mitzvah shivcho, since I read only part of the blurb. I value deeply, Rani, our friendship and the intellectual and the personal rewards that it has brought me. And I thank you for writing this book. And I thank all the people who were involved in its production. It is a tremendous achievement. I'd like to use this occasion over the next 4 hours or so to perform a mitzvah. And that is the mitzvah of remembering the Rav. To use some of the Rav's terminology, I would say that the speech is the ma'aseh ha-mitzvah, and my feelings and our collective feelings are the kiyum ha-mitzvah. The best way to remember a giant is through his words, divrehem heim heim zichronam. So I begin with the word of the Rav. It's on the pasuk Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adamah, that God created man out of the dust of the earth. And Rashi has two lashonos, two versions of where this dust came from. One of them is Sovar Aforo Me'arba Luchos, that God took the dust from the four corners of the earth. And the other is that he took it from the place of the Mizbeach. And the Rav, with his tremendous homiletic imagination, says that this really reflects two aspects of man. That on the one hand, the human being is cosmic. The human being wants to know everything, wants to experience everything. And at the same time, every person is rooted to a spot. And he writes, the home for which man yearns attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back no matter how far he has traveled. And he quotes Robert Louis Stevenson, home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill. I think that this vart brings out a great deal about the Rav's philosophy. Because the Rav in his philosophy roams far and wide, but he always returns to the basic themes, to the Mekom HaMizbeach, to the Halacha, to Emunah, and to Bris. If you look as a symbol, those of you familiar with the Halachic mind, 90 pages of relentlessly demanding philosophy, and then finally the last 10 pages about Judaism and a tremendous climax to the book. It also brings out something about the Rav himself. The Rav never explained why he was the way he was. He paints many, many personalities, but he doesn't quite portray a personality who was exactly himself, a giant in Torah, who at the same time had a tremendous mastery of philosophy and literature. So he doesn't really have an explicit description of himself. But I think that the one I just quoted comes very close. Cosmic man and the man rooted to his spot. But I also have a third thought about this art, and that is that it brings to mind a puzzle. And the puzzle is that precisely because the Rav always returned to the spot, precisely because he was so rooted in halacha and the issues of Judaism, it is puzzling that more and more he is being seen and embraced by people me'arba luchos, from people outside the world of orthodoxy. And the question is why. A scholar in Italy told me that he wants to produce a series of books in Italian on Jewish thought. And he'd like the first two to be translations of Lonely Man of Faith and Halachic Man. Let me tell you about the scholar from Italy. It's not every day you get a call from the Pope. Everybody got that one? Secondly, universities are offering courses in Buber, Rosenzweig, I think it's a different one, Levinas, and as they call it, the Son of Asia. A leading expert in religion called Lonely Man of Faith, quote, one of the most theologically intoxicating essays of the 20th century. Both Doubleday Press and Random House published The Lonely Man of Faith because its message was perceived by them as universal. And already decades ago, there was a prominent Reform rabbi, Rabbi Arnold Jacob Wolf, who said, after writing about Al Hatshuva, he said, if I am not mistaken, people will be reading him 1,000 years from now. Some of them will still be on the same page of halachic mind that they were on starting. Also, 2 months after the Rav died, I was at a conference, and a professor from Harvard said to me, I heard that you studied with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I said, yes. And you could see he was practically envious. The rest of the conversation was a little peculiar, because he said to me, so when did you study with him? Was it when did he work out the ideas of Lonely Man of Faith? So first of all, I must have looked a little older than I actually am. But I said, no, he didn't do philosophy in the class. I said, so what did he do? And I said, well, he taught Talmud. And the fellow looked completely, completely baffled. But at the same time, he clearly had a tremendous respect for the Rav's philosophy. Why is this? Why the people, Me'ar Baruchos, people from all over, with tangential relations to the Rav's religious world, to the world of orthodoxy, or even an antagonistic relationship to that world, why do they get drawn after his philosophy? Why does he resonate? Well, obviously, they are drawn to the genius, to the depth, to the passion, to the command of philosophy and literature and Jewish tradition. But there is more than that, and it's something that Rabbi Ziegler stresses loudly and clearly. And if I may just put it in my own word, it's because the Rav is real. He is authentic. He is, Rabbi Ziegler's word, grounded. And that is why he resonates. What do I mean? There is a very deep candor in the Rav's writings. There is intellectual integrity and honesty. The Rav understands human weaknesses and human vulnerabilities. He defines them, and he even talks about his own. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wrote that the Rav's legacy is, quote, not just spellbinding shiurim, magnificent drushos, electrifying chidushim, but the candid recognition of failure. He has imbued us, writes Rav Lichtenstein, with the sense of both the frailty of majesty and the majesty of frailty. And yet along with this is the affirmation that the human being can elevate himself or herself through struggle. The Rav doesn't paper over evil. He says that whatever God's reasons may be for allowing evil, we humans have to treat suffering as absurdities, as monstrosities, and must fight to overcome. That is real. The Rav appreciates that science and technology and economics and political science and all areas of human endeavor, all of the efforts of Adam the First, as depicted on Lonely Man of Faith, contribute to the conquest of disease, whatever dangers they bring. We are partners in creation. That is real. The Rav captures the complexity of life, its many-sidedness, its self-contradictory character, its antinomies, and its ambiguities. In short, I remember when the Rav used to be in Lamport Auditorium and he needed a drink of water, they would bring him a drink of water and he would say the Rav into the microphone. This is the loudest amazing that we've ever experienced. The Rav maintained that we have to oscillate between a sense of our own importance and a sense of our insignificance. A sense of goral, of fate, and a sense of yiyud, or destiny. That oscillation, that dialectic, is real. He is realistic that religion doesn't automatically bring happiness. Rav Shalom Carney, one of his most illustrious students, wrote, what did I learn from the Rav that I could not learn anywhere else? Writes Rabbi Carney, conventional religion tends to edit reality, to soft pedal conflict, to make the ugly aspects of reality disappear behind a rosy glow. The Rav's memorable and sometimes brutal honesty taught us that religion is no escape from conflict, but the ultimate encounter with reality. or as Rabbi Ziegler puts it, the frank acknowledgement of inconvenient facts. That is real. The Rav doesn't offer a sock to the masses. He attacks phony and flashy forms of religion that seek power and personal gain. He knows the dangers of extremism, and he uses dialectic as a brake or a bridle on extremism. And the people who associate religion with extremism, like those people, Me'ar Baruchos, he shows that there is a healthy alternative. And finally, people see an unshakable, indefatigable commitment, which they can admire without sharing, along with an extraordinary humility. What the Rav wrote about his wife, Tanya, Zichrona Livracha, is true of him too. Great courage, sublime dignity, total commitment, uncompromising truthfulness. All of that falls on receptive ears in the larger world. Rabbi Ziegler makes a fascinating point that in his early writings, the Rav depicted ideal types, paradigms, people who had reached the pinnacle of human achievement. That's in Halachic Man and Uvikashta Rishon. But in later writings, he focuses on typical people, on the struggles of incomplete and imperfect humans who, through their struggles, rise to great heights. I conjecture that we live in an age that is very receptive to all this. Because even though there is a great deal of psychobabble, people nevertheless care probably more than ever about understanding themselves. They own up to complexity. They are more willing to acknowledge weaknesses and vulnerabilities, so some of those tell-all books contain what they call TMI, too much information. Somebody joked that he's going to write an unauthorized autobiography. The ability to succeed, we now know, depends on the willingness to fail. Someone told me there's a book that makes exactly this point to explain why Israel has more startup companies than anybody else. It's because they're willing to fail. These are the reasons, I think, why the Rav is attractive to those people, Me'ar Baruchos, who are not part of his world. What about the Mekom HaMizbeach? What about his place in Orthodoxy? Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, Olav HaShalom, said, punning on the Pasuk, Mechashefa lo sechayeh, you should not let a sorceress live. He says, some people misread that and think it says, Mechashefa lo sechayeh, that you should not keep philosophy. Now, there's a difference between Israel and the United States in this regard, where Israel philosophy percolates, and in America it had been somewhat marginalized. The Rav generated fantastic passion for Talmud Torah among thousands and thousands of people. But philosophy was a different story. And I found that in talking to people, very often they would say to me, oh, I started the book of the Rav, I couldn't understand a word. And I say these people can master the most complex sugyas and shas. And if there was a sentence that they couldn't understand in a sefer, they would call up people, they would ask them questions about it, they would go to CD-ROMs and dictionaries, see the word teleological, close the book. Well, Orthodoxy, I think, has changed in how it looks at the Rav. Not that far back, people questioned whether he really valued philosophy. By now, so much stuff is out that the answer is clear. I remember Moshe Lichtenstein said after the Rav passed away that if you want to know whether the Rav was interested in general culture, look at his library. Well, now we can also say, look at his drawer. Look at all the manuscripts that he left. The Rav was attacked in his lifetime. Now he's quoted in circles where he was never quoted by name before. But still, we need people to elucidate and to explain. And I think that Rabbi Ziegler's book will bring the Rav's philosophy to many in our society and for generations to come. And I hope that this Masa HaMitzvah, that the talks we are giving today, can lead to the Kiyum, to that deep inner love for and devotion to the Rav's persona, and the Rav's voice, and the Rav's writings. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Thank you very much.
Firstly, I just express my appreciation of being invited to speak here this afternoon with such illustrious members of the panel. It's particularly a pleasure for me to be here on the occasion of the launching of the book of Rabbi Ziegler, who is a special talmid of mine, one of my original talmidim, my first year of teaching all the way back, and we reunited, as I recall, couple of years after his experience in Eretz Yisrael, and we've been connected really from the beginning and throughout the course of all of these years. And that first year I had, I believe, 8 Talmidim, and it made afforded the opportunity to develop a special kesher with each and every one of them, and something that remains to this very day. So to be here, to be present at a milestone in his life, which is also a milestone for our community, to be involved in spreading the Torah of all of our Rebbe or Soloveitchik, is really something that is very unique and very special. All the aspects of the Shinantam, the Vanecha, are really bound up one in the other, and more than the sum of its parts. What I thought I would do just very briefly is discuss three very short points or issues that I want to raise, which I think also highlight the uniqueness of the Rav's approach, his thought, and where I think this book by Rabbi Ziegler is particularly poised to make an important contribution. The most unique feature in Rav's thinking, as alluded to by Dr. Schatz just a couple of minutes ago, is the interface between, the interconnection between general philosophy and halachic thought, the world of Torah, mitzvos, and halacha. Unique among thinkers, Rav Soloveitchik was able to integrate the norms of halacha, what it is that we're obligated to do, the prescriptive aspects of our life, together with the values, the thoughts, the Weltanschauung of the world of halakha. It seems like something that is very obvious, self-evident, that a system which emphasizes performance, mitzvos, kiyuma mitzvos, the world of halakha, magnificent, grand structure, would also find its value system embedded and reflected in those very norms. It seems self-evident, but the fact is that in the world of Jewish thought, it's very rare, if not singular. You could go all the way back to the time of Chazal. That's a little more difficult to catalog. But certainly if you look at the medieval period, no one was a greater thinker than the Rambam. No one was a greater halachist than the Rambam. But the critique of the Rambam's thinking, of the work of Mor Nebuchadnezzar in particular, is that it doesn't integrate well the values and norms of the halakha, at least not in a very compelling way, and the world of philosophy that the Rambam projects in that work. The critique of Mor Nebuchadnezzar is that it's too Aristotelian, that it creates too much of a compartmentalized worldview. And well, I think that in some respects that's harsh, and that if one integrates the total picture presented not only by Mor Nebuchadnezzar, but by the beginning of Yad HaChazaka, obviously, by the Rambam's magnificent mental energy that is thrown into each and every sugya, the tshuvas of the Rambam, the egros of the Rambam, I think it somewhat changes that picture. But the fact is that this is a critique that can be leveled because, at minimum, the Rambam does seem to be projecting two different worldviews. The same is true in the medieval world, the world of Kabbalah. The Ramban, the Rajba, the Raivid, the less well-known, many other of the great authorities of Halakha were also Kabbalists. They were Jewish mystics. If you examine their mysticism, of course, it is connected to the material of the halakha, but the gap between halakhic values, normally analyzed, normally understood, and that theosophic world of the Kabbalah is really great. It's, again, two different systems that overlap rather than a single or integrated system. In the modern era, there have been all sorts of efforts, again, to formulate a Weltanschauung which is connected to the world of halakha. Rav Kook, Rav Hirsch, to mention two of the prominent modern ones. But again, the popular critique of both, and again, it's not the proper venue to analyze whether I think this is legitimate or not, but it's a widespread comment that neither, again, of these great halakhic authorities really integrates well the norms of halakha as values with their system of thought. For Rav Kook, again, mysticism, other strands of his thought seem quite different than his Sifrei Halakha. And to some extent, although I think less so, this is true of Rav Hirsch as well. The philosophy of the Rav is founded on the principle that the world of halakha constitutes not only, and not necessarily primarily, a world of action and prescription, but it reflects an ideational world. It's a blueprint of values that are embedded in the halakhic norm. That's a very compelling and powerful idea, one which enhances both hashkafa and halakha at the same time. Even to contrast it with other works which gave primacy to the halakha, the parashas drachim of the Mishnah Melech, more recent times, the works ala Torah of Rav Belbel, Rav Zankel. There you have a situation where Dibrei Agada or philosophy is halakhicized. In the Rav's works, you have an analysis of halakhic values, which generates a corresponding world of thoughts and of values. And while it shouldn't be, it is, in fact, absolutely unique. This is true not only in the integration of halakha and hashkafa, but as a particular component connected to the world, to the philosophy of halakha that the Rav himself advocated, the world of brisk. Again, without going into further detail, the world of brisk reflects a certain particular orientation in halakha, one which sees the halakha as transcendent and which focuses on the inner coherence of that world, how it internally is consistent. The world of brisk is not interested in explaining or rationalizing the halakha, but in understanding it from the inside. That makes more challenging the effort to extract values from the norms. At the same time, it also establishes a greater payoff when that is accomplished, and that when that is accomplished as magnificently as the Rav Zatzal was able to execute it. And therefore, from one perspective, while it may be true that the rest of the world has come, and it's a remarkable phenomenon, as Dr. Schatz indicated, to a great sense of appreciation of the Rav, notwithstanding his origins and ultimately his destiny, it takes a nuanced understanding and appreciation of the world of Torah and, to some extent, of the world of Bris to fully appreciate and to fully comprehend Rav Soloveitchik's thoughts. Therefore, it's only someone who is ensconced both in the Beis Medrash and has taken steps to appreciate that wider vision and the larger philosophy that the Rav propounds who is capable, really, of conveying and of articulating, of integrating the Rav's own writings. That's, I think, one aspect where this work by someone who Rosh Ogurubo has been and remains and identifies with the world of Beis Medrash, with the Derech HaLimud of Rav Soloveitchik, of Har Yeshiva, of the Shivat Har Etzion, and its Rosh Yeshiva, of Bar Lichtenstein Shlita, is someone who is very capable, only someone like that, very capable of really conveying accurately the Rav's thought. The second closely related element is another issue which constitutes a kind of inherent tension, even a dialectic, in parallel thought systems, particularly thought systems centering around the world of the halakha. The relationship between Yiras Shemayim on the one hand, the fear of heaven, fervent religiosity on the one hand, and creativity, a sense of appreciating freshness of an insight, an innovative articulation, or even a new idea, but one which remains rooted in the Masorah. The idea of creativity and Masorah, tradition and innovation, obviously is challenging. And again, there's a long history trying to grapple with this tension. The Bali Tosfos of the medieval period, the medieval Ashkenaz, basically responsible for a kind of revolution in Derech HaLimud, in the methodology of study of Torah. And they were met with a sharp and harsh, in some cases, critique by some of their fellows, particularly those associated with the school of Chassidei Ashkenaz, the German pietists, who suggested that that creativity undermined the sense of tradition, and especially the sense of reverence. If you can read a text and your own logic and analysis can dictate the direction that you take, then what does that imply about the need for being the Shamesh, Rebbe, standing in a tradition, reflecting a certain measure of piety and humility, etc.? The same kind of tension exists as a response to the Pilpul innovations in a much later period of history, 16th century, in a different aspect, the 18th century. And the same kind of tension is reflected in the response to Brisk, when Brisk became a very powerful force in the world of Torah. The critique of the Marfeshes and the Ritvaz and others that Reb Chaim's Dera essentially freed people from the Masorah, and that it encouraged independence, which bordered on arrogance, is something which is very, very well documented. But a deeper understanding of the world of Brisk, particularly as it's articulated by the Rav in his Ish Halacha and Madomei Midon and in his other works, and which is reflected in every shiur that he gave and every public lecture as well, if only people were sensitive enough and aware enough to understand it, is essentially to completely neutralize that problem and that critique. The world of Brisk and the Rav's thinking in particular is based on the assumption of inner coherence, of surrendering to the will and to the categories and to the logic of the world of halacha. So that innovation and creativity, highly prized in the Rav's thinking, is the innovation and the creativity of an insider, someone who has already invested time and especially mental energy and yiras shamayim to becoming an insider. One who has been the batel, ritzono, the ritzono mako, one who surrenders to the halakhic system, then becomes a player from within. One whose insight is part of that Masorah, at the same time is innovative and can propel that Masorah forward. And again, it's only someone who has that appreciation of that tension and who understands how the Rav's thinking gives a new twist or wrinkle to an old idea. The story that the Gemara tells in Menachal is about Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu initially couldn't understand what it was that Rabbi Akiva was even saying when the Rabbanu Sholom gave him the opportunity to hear one of the lectures of Rabbi Akiva. But upon hearing that all of this stemmed from his own tradition, understood exactly how to connect the dots, how the Chidushim were really part of the Masorah. But to understand that, one has to, again, be ensconced both in the world of the Beis Medrash, as well as to have an appreciation for creativity and the impact of creativity in religious life, religious growth and development. And again, our author is somebody who's trained that way, exposed to great men like the Rav and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and was capable of conveying that. The third element, I think, relates very specifically to the future prospects, the idea of developing curricula based on the Rav's writings. Again, Schefter mentioned this in his words of introduction. Dr. Schatz, I know, has been involved in this as well. The challenge of taking the thought of a great man, which is highly nuanced and subtle, That's part of what is unique and singular about it. And instead of diluting it, trying to capture it in a way that remains true to the integrity of his thinking, while at the same time allowing for it to have impact in a wider world. Whether it be the secular world, which is not ensconced in Beis Medrash, or in the Beis Medrash world, which doesn't have a sufficient appreciation always of the world of thought and philosophy, or even to those who are committed to both. And here I think, again, this work, I've only been able to look at it very cursorily, is a very important contribution in that direction. Not only because Divrei HaRav, Ashir b'makom echad v'ani b'makom acher, just the juxtaposition of the Rav's writing and thinking on different topics from someone who has spent much time and thought, and in a thoughtful way has juxtaposed them together, but also the idea that it's inconsistent with who the Rav was and what his thinking was, for us merely to be satisfied with understanding what he said. Part of his message is the idea of propelling forward, looking for more nuances, building upon that work. So my time is up, certainly. As I said before, it's really a special privilege for me to give a yashar koach to Rabbi Zeman and the yashar koach.
Dr. Schatz and Reverend Rosenzweig so much for coming and participating and sharing such extraordinarily important insights. It's now a real pleasure to present Rabbi Ziegler. We've been waiting for a long time for this. It's such a precious and special moment. You've done an extraordinary work. You have contributed in extraordinary measure to the perpetuation of the life and the teachings of Rav Soloveitchik. We are all in your debt. We thank you very, very much. There will be a book signing after Rabbi Ziegler concludes. There are a couple of books here, but the book signing will take place downstairs. Everybody's invited downstairs to follow up with Rabbi Ziegler on any issues that you may want to raise with him. It's a pleasure to present Rabbi Reuven Ziegler.
I want to pick up on some themes that the previous speakers mentioned, particularly concerning perpetuating the Rav's legacy and the way I think would be most appropriate to go about that. But first, one of the things that the Rav taught us is about the how Hakaras HaTov is really a cornerstone of religious life and of moral life in general. And therefore, I want to just reiterate some of the thanks that were said before and to add some of my own. First, I want to thank the panelists. Not just for agreeing to be here tonight, Rabbi Schachter shepherded this project from its very beginning many years ago at every stage, and the book would not have come out without him, and I appreciate it very much. And Dr. Schatz, you've been in voluminous email correspondence over the past decade or so, and I've gained much from it and collaborated on many projects, and I thank him for taking on a junior partner and helping me enter into this world of research and Jewish thought. And moreover, Rabbi Rosenzweig, what can I say other than that? I thank him for being Moreover Rabbi and for really embodying for me the Rav's ideas in a very concrete way. I also want to thank all the speakers for agreeing to read the words that my mother wrote so accurately. Just the words of praise, the ideas were yours. Praise for the book. And I want to thank, of course, the family of Abraham Lubavitz, who sponsored this book, the Rabbi Soloveitchik Institute, the publishers, Urim and Maimonides and OU, Yeshivat Har Etzion, my spiritual home and my physical home nearby. And I'm very happy to be back at my alma mater, YU, where I spent many years of my youth, many very precious years. A few weeks ago, the book came out in Israel. It's just reaching America now, today, I think. And we made, the book arrived on a Friday, and my wife basically arranged a little kiddush. And so I spoke, I think that people were surprised the next morning when I gave some brief remarks. I started by quoting a conversation I had with the Breslover Chassid, who which would seem to have nothing to do with the Rav. This fellow told me a very interesting story. He was in Berkeley in the 60s, not Frum, dropped out of college, was living in a redwood forest, and not exactly the lifestyle of a halachic man. And one day, he went into San Francisco, and he saw a place called the House of Love and Prayer, which was the shul of Shlomo Carlebach. And he thought, it looks like an interesting place. He walked in, and he heard Shlomo Carlebach giving a shir on Rav Nachman. And he said, I didn't understand why there was anyone else in the room, because clearly Rav Nachman was talking to me personally. And today this fellow is the leading scholar of Breslov music and has a beautiful family and is a scholar and propagator of the traditions of Breslov. And I had a very similar experience. I wasn't living in a redwood forest, but I was here at MTA in high school, and when I first read the Rav, and it spoke to me in such a direct and personal way, exactly the issues, the problems, the dilemmas, the tensions, it was as if he was writing it for me. Not that I was the lucky man, but I felt that the works really spoke to me, they were directed at me personally. And I continue to feel this, that the Rav is speaking to me. Although what spoke to me at the age of 16, I might different parts of the Rav's writings might speak to me more now, as would be natural. This powerful experience is really something that I carry along with me, and therefore it was a tremendous schus when I came into possession of hundreds of the Rav's manuscripts later in life through Rav Lichtenstein. And then through the Tversky family, and I had the opportunity, along with Dr. Schatz and Dr. Wolowelski and others, to publish some of these, to bring them to the attention of the greater world. So I felt that the way the Rav had spoken to me personally and had helped me and had helped shape me, even though I didn't know him personally, I had my first year in YU was his last year. I mean, I hope there's no causal relationship. But it was a coincidence, and so I had the privilege of beholding him, like the Gemara says, Chazise Me'achore, but I was never exposed to him directly. But I feel that he is my Rebbe, and I've sat and had chavrusa with him every morning for the past decade, reading his, listening to his tapes, reading his manuscripts. This past Shabbos, I was in the Rav's hometown. I was in the Maimonides school, and I spoke there about what the community in Israel can learn from the Rav and is learning the Rav and why his influence there is growing. And I spoke about what, in general, we today can and should learn from the Rav. Yet, even though I wrote an entire book on the Rav, and even though I devote myself professionally to perpetuating and spreading his legacy, I think it's important to point out that the Rav wanted us to be his Talmidim and not to be his Hasidim. He used to say, Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbeh, meaning, the way he interpreted it was, make your Talmidim stand up on their own two feet. They should think for themselves. They should have their own ideas. And he would be the first to admit that if his thought doesn't speak to you. He says this in Lonely Man of Faith and other writings. He said, these are my personal interpretations. This is my subjective understanding of Judaism. Everyone's understanding of Judaism is subjective. But he says, this is how I understand it. If this resonates with my audience, matov. And if not, then you should feel free to find a different approach within the framework of halacha that resonates with you personally, or that resonates with your community, with your own individual issues. I think the Rav would want us to read his writings and to read his thoughts just like we should read his shiur with a critical eye, to feel free to disagree, to draw different conclusions, to conclude that his ideas were more applicable in a different time, and today, because things have changed, maybe we need different emphases, different insights. And I think it's important that as much as we're all concerned with perpetuating the Rav's legacy, and I believe that it has tremendous value, and that these books that we've produced, Dr. Schatz and others, these are really nichsei tzon barzel of Am Yisrael, and as the Reform Rabbi said, some of these books it will be read, I think, in 1,000 years. Nevertheless, we today, especially those who live in his orbit, especially those in Yeshiva University or in his greater community, the modern Orthodox community, the religious Zionist community, we shouldn't feel stifled by his thought. We should feel that his thought should be an inspiration to us and a source for our own creativity. As we know, the Rav, one of the way he had a very unique interpretation of the Halacha Bidrachav, where he said that one of the cornerstone, he said several times, of Judaism is to imitate God. The way it's usually understood is Mahu Rahu Mahata Rahu. He's merciful, we should be merciful. He does chesed, we should do chesed. The Rav said no. The primary way that we have to imitate God is just as God is creative, so too should we be creative. God is a creator of worlds, we should be creators of worlds. And I think that this is the way he would want us to learn his writings and to apply his writings and his thoughts. And just briefly, let's look at, as we mentioned before, his one of his greatest talmidim, certainly someone who's his talmid mochak, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Lesman de Palik, that he's someone who is tremendously influenced by the Rav, shaped by the Rav, and sees himself as personally committed to perpetuating the Rav's legacy. Yet, he's not the Rav, and he doesn't, sometimes he takes the Rav's ideas and applies them to new areas that the Rav didn't. Sometimes he takes the Rav's ideas and draws different conclusions than the Rav himself did. Some of his ideas are completely independent of things that the Rav may have said, and I'll just give very, very brief examples. And, you know, Mahu Afanachnu, if such a Talmud Muha can my brother-in-law learned in Yeshiva Sibirsk in Yerushalayim, and he said that the goal in Yeshiva was to say over Torahs of the Griz on Kodshim. That's all. Not to come up with your own Chidushim, but to learn what Reb Velbel said on Kodshim and to be able to pass it on. And I think that the Rav had a very different approach than this. As exemplified, I think that Rav Lichtenstein, because he's a Talmud of the Rav, feels that though he works within the orbit of the Rav, he should also be free to develop his own individual approach and feel free to disagree when the occasion is demanded. It's like Rav Amital said on many occasions, he said that he really was shaped by Rav Kook. And Rav Kook is what kept him going through the Shoah. He brought a little pamphlet of Rav Kook's writings with him to the Nazi labor camp. He said, that's what kept him going. He said, yet because I'm a Talmud of Rav Kook, I think that I must disagree with Rav Kook on certain things. Because Rav Kook lived before the Shoah. He didn't see the Shoah. He lived before Midnight Israel. He never saw it. And I saw things that he didn't, and therefore, because I'm his Talmud, I have to disagree. And I'll just give a couple of short examples before moving on to one or two other issues in the Rav's thought. To keep it brief, I'll just skip to the end of this. The Rav, everyone knows, started off in Aguda and switched to Mizrahi because he felt that Yad Hashem was apparent in the creation of Medinat Israel, and he felt that cornerstone of his thought was human activism and the need for humans to build and develop and create. And he felt that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had paskin in the machloket between Aguda and Mizrahi, that Mizrahi was correct. And therefore he felt it was very important to be supportive of Medinat Israel and to love Medinat Israel, to be concerned about Medinat Israel, to help Medinat Israel. Rav Lichtenstein certainly took all these, but he drew a different conclusion. He felt that the conclusion from this is that we should make aliyah to Medinat Israel, and that we should work from the inside to shape it, not to support it from the outside, but to be a Rosh Yeshiva Tezder, and to help shape Israeli society from the inside. And moreover, he also said that it's not just that there's Yad Hashem in the creation of the Midinah. He saw other values in Midinah Israel, which the Rav didn't develop. He felt that there was an organic quality to religious life in Eretz Israel, and that Jewish life in the diaspora was more fragmented. When you go to work, you're at work. When you go to school, you're in school. And when you're in shul, you're in shul. But he felt that all of society in Israel had a unique, organic quality. He felt that without going into mysticism, but the Kedushas Haaretz lends a different quality to Kiyum HaMitzvot in Eretz Israel. He felt that Israel is the epicenter of Jewish life, even though there's Eretz Yisrael and Babel, and Babel is important. And he doesn't want to negate the value of diaspora communities, unlike other religious Zionist thinkers. But still, the center of the Jewish people, the center of Kahal Yisrael, is in Eretz Yisrael. And for all these reasons, and for others, he felt that despite the fact that he had imbibed his religious Zionism from the Rav, he drew a different conclusion than the Rav drew. Another issue is it's well known that Rav Lichtenstein thinks that there's great religious and spiritual value to the study of literature. And Rav Soloveitchik appreciated literature, but he, when he was looking for a spiritual sustenance to be found outside the world of Torah, he found it in the world of science, in the world of philosophy, in the world of theology. And he constantly, Rav Lichtenstein has said, that the Rav continually urged him to study more science and study more mathematics, and he would see the beauty of it and the greatness of it. And Rav Lichtenstein said when he was in college, he took courses in math and science, not because the Rav told him to, but because he said, if he sees something in it, then I want to take it and see what he sees in it. And he didn't really see what the Rav saw in it, but he did see it in literature. And then after he got his PhD in literature, the Rav made him a party. And then the Rav said, Mazel Tov, I'm your doctorate in literature, and now that you got literature out of your system, now you'll study some science. Rav Lichtenstein felt free to develop his own approach and to develop his own ideas, and he's devoted many essays. The Rav, by the way, as Dr. Schatz pointed out in an essay of his, the Rav never wrote a programmatic essay, Why I Believe in the Study of Philosophy. Rav Lichtenstein has written several programmatic essays, Why I Believe in the Study of Literature, so we can see he sets out exactly what he thinks there is to be gained from it. His most in-depth treatment of it is in a book that Rabbi Schachter edited, Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures. And there, I think that you can't ask for a more thorough treatment of the issue than that which Rav Lichtenstein has there. So I think that this approach of Rav Lichtenstein can be a model for those who appreciate the Rav's philosophy, who identify with the Rav's philosophy, but nevertheless should feel free to develop their own approach and to take the Rav's ideas in different directions than the Rav might have been willing to do himself. And the Rav himself was, as I said, the Rav himself did not want people to do things because he did them, or to believe things because he believed them. He wanted people to listen, understand, weigh it, and continue from there. And if they were convinced, then they should follow his path. And in one of the next, I'll give you a preview of not the next volume of the Rav that's coming out. There's one that's going to come out in another 2 months or so. It's in proofreading now. But the one after that, I'll quote a little passage from what he writes. He says that there are two aspects of religious life. There's the halakhic framework and the framework of Jewish values. But within that, there's room for many different religious styles, many different religious approaches. For example, you know, if you're keeping taryag mitzvos and you have the basic Jewish values, so who's to tell you whether to be a chassid or a misnagid? Which way is right? There's no correct answer to that. Or who's to tell you whether to be an elitist like Beis Shammai or a democratic approach like Beis Hillel? Who's to tell you whether to focus your Judaism on Talmud Torah or to focus it on tefillah or to focus it on chesed? In other words, as long as you're engaged in all three, but everyone will put his emphasis, each individual will put his emphasis in a different area. The Rebbe says that, and he says that no one can tell someone else how to be in this way. He says, because if I tell him what religious style to adopt, I'm telling him to be me. But he's not me. I'm me, he's him. He has to decide for himself. That's why Talmidim of the Rebbe and Talmidim of Lichtenstein have the same experience. It could be frustrating because he wouldn't tell you what to do. People would go to him with a dilemma and say, you know, should I, take this job? Should I do this? Should I do that? And he wouldn't answer. He would help you clarify the considerations in each direction. And Talmidim of Rav Lichtenstein know this phenomenon also. Those who want him to make your decisions for you will be very frustrated. But he's not doing it because he's unwilling to take responsibility. He's doing it because it's illegitimate to make that decision for you. It's a decision that you have to make for yourself, and you have to take the responsibility for your own decision, and you know what's best for you better than he does. So this is a theme that will come up in the in two books from now in the row. I'll just quote a short passage, and then a final thought. The Rav writes, each individual finds in the colorful Dot experience whatever appeals to him. He searches through the total span of the spectrum of religious experience. He will find that some shafts of colorful and brilliant light, notwithstanding their high moral potential, do not correspond to his innate moral being, and they are only remotely related to the needs which he considers the strongest. In a word, the selection of the basic norms of the religious experience depends upon the organization of the self. That is why there's no psak halacha in matters of religious style, of hashkafa. That's why no controversy on these matters was resolved by the Masorah in accordance with the rule of the majority. Because psak halacha would imply standardization of practices. This would contradict the very essence of hashkafa, of the choosing a religious style. And now I want to make one final observation. The Rav, as is well known, was a dialectical thinker. Now, a dialectical thinker believes that there are two values that are different, maybe even opposed to each other, yet both are important, and we have to try to grasp both. And the Rav believed that we live in the tension between the dialectical pulls in different directions. Now, that's true in the larger sense. However, whenever a thinker like the Rav, a dialectical thinker like the Rav, would speak to an audience, which side is he going to emphasize? He's going to emphasize the side that's weak in his audience. He doesn't have to tell them if he believes in A and B, and they believe in A, so he'll say A and B are both important, but then he'll spend the rest of his speech talking about the importance of B. For example, here, we're in Yeshiva University today, so I thought this is a good example, Toro Mata. So, the Rav, of course, was the exemplar of Toro Mata. What it means, he never wrote a programmatic essay. What side are you going to talk about if you believe in Torah Mada? So if you come to an audience that believes in Talmud Torah and doesn't believe in the importance of Mada, you'll spend most of your time expressing the importance of Mada, because they don't need to be strengthened in their Torah study. If you come to an audience that's strong in Mada and that believes in that, but they don't see the value of Talmud Torah, you'll spend most of your time talking about the value of Torah. And the same with anything else. Now, the Rav, in his essays, goes through a whole series of dialectics. But he clearly leans in one direction in each of his essays. And the question is whether, if he's emphasizing one side when he was writing 50 years ago, today, should we be emphasizing the other side? It's important when you read the Rav's essays and you see that he's emphasizing one thing, you have to try to get the big picture and to see what's he really saying. He's really saying that A and B are important, even though 90% of this essay is about B. And maybe in our day, everyone knows B. And we have to really emphasize A. So if we want to be real Talmidim of the Rav, and if we really want to appreciate his values, we have to be willing to reassess whether the side that was weak in his day, that he felt the need to emphasize, is still weak today. I could give a couple of examples. I'll just name a couple briefly, and then I'll conclude. For example, in The Lonely Man of Faith, he talks about Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1, majestic, creative man, creates culture, civilization, society, all for religious reasons, because he's answering God's call of Ritu Baratz B'Chiv Shua. On the other hand, there's Adam 2, humble man, covenantal man, sacrificial man, who is willing to limit himself, to accept God's tzivui, to enter into the brit with Kadosh Baruch Hu by giving up of himself. Now, he talks in the essay about how God wants us to be, Adam 1 and Adam 2. But the second half of the essay, and the whole emphasis of the essay, is Adam 2. Because, not just because Adam 2 is ultimately more important, which I think is the case, but still he believes in Adam 1 and Adam 2. But when was he writing? In the 1960s. Man was reaching out for the moon. You know, they were conquering civilization, technology. Everyone knew that man's job was to conquer. People were arrogant, and he was trying to stress that no, religion also demands that you limit yourself, that you be humble, that you be willing to sacrifice, and that's the side that he emphasizes, because that's the side that his audience needed to hear. It could be that in different places, different times, we might need to go back in the other direction. One theme I spoke about yesterday in Boston was about how the Rav talked about how Judaism is a discipline and a romance, and that both these aspects are essential for the self-realization of the religious personality. what does he mean by discipline? He says Judaism is a discipline of thought and a discipline of action. Discipline of thought is Talmud Torah in the most rigorous, analytic, brisker form. That's discipline of thought. Discipline of action is Shmirat HaMitzvot, you know, Al Kutzos Shel Yud, Pirtei Pratim of the Halacha, to be Mekayim the Mitzvot in the most medaktic possible way. So that's one aspect of Judaism, the discipline. On the other hand, Judaism, he says, is a romance. There's an inner, yearning, passionate quest, experiential aspect. And then he goes through why each side is important. If you just have the inner, yearning, passionate experience, but it's not disciplined, it's volatile, it can dissipate quickly, it can go off in all sorts of undesirable directions, so it needs to be disciplined. On the other hand, if you just have the discipline without the romance, so it's dry, it's soulless, it's meaningless. And he said you need to integrate both of these aspects in your Kiyum HaMitzvot. Now, in his day, he said, I have seen success in trying to convey the discipline of Judaism. And I think that my Talmidim know how to learn a sugya, and they've adopted the discipline of thought of Judaism. And I think that my Talmidim understand the importance of Kiyum HaMitzvot, and that they're Shomer Shabbat Kala Kechamura and Shomer Mitzvot Kala Kechamura. However, I feel that they have not succeeded in absorbing the experiential dimension of Judaism. And they're perplexed, and their Judaism is without emotional depth. And therefore, he devoted a lot of attention to discussing, in many of the works that we have put out in Family Redeemed and in others, the inner experiential dimension of Judaism. Now, it could be, and here I hark back to my opening with Breslov and Reform Karlovach, it could be that today people understand the romance of Judaism, and they look for it, and they find it in Karlovach, in Breslov, elsewhere. And today we may need to go back and emphasize the discipline. Maybe people don't understand the importance of the discipline of Judaism. And so we might have to learn the Rav, not the way the Rav learned the Rav, but the Rav learned the Rav 50 years ago. And so we, learning the Rav, either 50 years later, or on a different continent in Israel, or wherever we may be, or in Italy, or in... I'll just mention that I was in correspondence with someone who's finishing a translation of The Lonely Man of Faith into Czech. So if anyone here has been working on a Czech translation of The Lonely Man of Faith, you should stop, because it's been done. Also, there's a French translation of various of his works going on, another aspect where we might have to emphasize the other side of the dialectic than the Rav did is the issue of Chok u'Mishpat. Mishpat, the use of reason versus Chok, accepting that which we can't understand. And as I said, in the mid-50s, when the Rav was speaking, when man was landing on the moon and reason was written, people needed to understand, and the Rav emphasized that there are limits to the human intellect. And that there are things we can't understand, that we can't use the intellect to legislate moral norms, and that there are limits to what we can understand. However, it could be, I'm not saying that it is or it isn't, but we have to think, today, is that the case? Or today, do religious people assume that there's no role for reason in Judaism and in religion? And that today, we shouldn't utilize our judgment, our intellect, our independent thought, and that we just have to accept everything as fukim. I think that there is a danger that people are accepting all sorts of superstitions and all sorts of, because they say, you know, it's not my place to think. The Gedolim do the thinking for me, and I don't need to think. So today, instead of emphasizing the chok, we may need to emphasize the mishpat, that we should recognize the danger of uncritical thought, and we should realize the power of the intellect, and to give it its proper place. It has its limits, but it also has its proper place. So, to conclude, the Rav wanted his students, his readers, not to passively accept what he said. He wanted them to work hard. As we said, the writings are hard because he wanted you to put effort into it. It shouldn't be so easy to understand. He wanted you to work hard, but he also wanted you to read critically and to seek that which resonates for you and to apply it in a way that's appropriate for you and for your time and for your place. And only in this way can each individual realize his own individual task and mission in the world, by reading it critically and thinking if it's appropriate for his time. And if any readers of the Rav will read my book and will then not say, the Rav believed X, therefore I believe X, but they'll say, this resonates with me, and this is meaningful, and this will help me attain my mission in life, then that will be my reward.
Thank you.
again to Rabbi Ziegler of the Yeshikoach. Thank you so much for our panelists. Thank you for coming. Have a good afternoon. Please remember there's a book signing downstairs.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. We'll see you.